Deutsche Welle Spotlight on Europe.
Hello and welcome to an exciting edition of Spotlight on Europe. From our studios in Bonn, Germany, my name is Wanjiko Mwaura. On today's program, can just anyone get a European Union visa?
If a terrorist comes here, if a criminal comes here, the government has the right to give them a passport. There's no problem with that.
And driving for the taxi service Uber is becoming a dangerous occupation in Turkey. We'll hear all about that and more shortly, but first, we start with the news. Here is Natalie Muller with this roundup of news from Europe.
The controversial Nord Stream 2 project has received final approval from Berlin. The 1,200-kilometre pipeline is to bring natural gas from Russia to northern Germany via the Baltic Sea. But many Eastern European countries are worried it'll have political and security implications, such as greater energy dependence on Moscow. Many states are also cautious about doing more business with Russia when it's been accused of carrying out a chemical attack on UK soil. The green light from Germany was announced a day after Berlin expelled four Russian diplomats over that attack. The US, Australia, Canada, and more than a dozen other EU countries did the same. Nord Stream 2 is a subsidiary of Russian state-controlled energy giant Gazprom and says it hopes to complete the 9.5 billion euro pipeline by the end of next year. Finland, Denmark, and Sweden are yet to issue permits for the project. Ireland is set to hold a landmark vote on May 25th to decide whether to change its constitution to make abortion legal. The predominantly Catholic nation has some of the strictest abortion laws in Europe, prompting thousands of Irish women to travel abroad each year to terminate their pregnancies. The constitution's Eighth Amendment, passed in 1983, stipulates that abortion is illegal unless the mother's life is threatened. Poland has signed the largest arms procurement contract in the country's history. It struck a $4.75 billion deal with the United States to buy an air defense Patriot missile system. It includes 16 launchers, four radars, and the latest fire control system to be delivered in 2022. Most of Poland's weapons date back to the Cold War era, but the NATO member has sought to modernise its military in recent years in response to Russian assertiveness in the region, particularly after Moscow's annexation of Crimea in 2014. Britain has announced plans to introduce a charge on plastic, glass and metal drink bottles in a bid to bring down pollution. Under the scheme, consumers will have to pay a deposit, but they'll get the money back if they return the container. Around 13 billion plastic drink bottles are used each year in the UK, and less than half are recycled. Environment Minister Michael Gove said the bottle deposit plan would reduce waste and help curb pollution in the ocean. Similar schemes are in place in Scandinavian countries and here in Germany, where consumers can be charged up to 25 euro cents per bottle. The European Union says it wants to set up a military Schengen zone to make it easier to move troops and defence equipment around the bloc, in much the same way that citizens can travel freely in the EU's passport-free area. The proposal from the European Commission calls for transport corridors to be identified and for roads and bridges to be upgraded so they can cope with tanks and other heavy loads. NATO has been pushing for improved military mobility in the face of growing tensions with Russia. Officials said customs checks and unnecessary bureaucracy were hampering NATO forces and vehicles trying to cross borders. More babies were born in Germany in 2016 than in any other year since 1996. Germany is Europe's most populous nation, but it has suffered from low birth rates since the 1970s. According to the Federal Statistical Office, around 790,000 babies were born in the recent surge, and it's lifted the overall fertility rate to 1.59 babies per woman, the highest recorded level since 1973. The agency said the increase was due to more women over 30 deciding to have children, as well as the arrival of large numbers of migrants. France has the highest birth rate in Europe at 1.92, while women in Spain and Italy have the fewest children at 1.34.
That was Natalie Muller with the news. This song is called Adeba by Monique Seka, and she is actually the third generation of a musical dynasty of Ivory Coast. Seka is the daughter of Seka Okoye, an Ivorian singer famous in the 1970s. Enjoy. Adeba. Now, here's a question. Should Libya, a country with two dysfunctional governments and various local factions, be considered a safe place for migrants rescued at sea to be returned? Well, last week, an incident between the Libyan Coast Guard and a search and rescue ship from Spanish NGO Open Arms renewed the migrant debate. The organization Doctors Without Borders, MSF, says it's seeing European governments actively looking to criminalize and block NGOs from conducting search and rescues in the central Mediterranean Sea. Now, the only remaining ship operating those missions off the Libyan coast is the SOS MSF Aquarius. DW reporter Philip Warwick filed this report from on board.
Considering it's 41 years old, the NGO ship Aquarius looks pretty good for its age. The former German Coast Guard vessel was laid in Bremen and sailed the North and Baltic Sea. 4 decades later, it's 32 kilometers off the Libyan coast in the central Mediterranean SAR zone, better known as the Search and Rescue Zone. Patrolling international waters, the German-run NGO SOS Mediterranean and its multinational crew responsible for search and rescue carefully scanned the horizon from the ship's bridge for any signs of boats in distress. Should people be rescued, then the Médecins Sans Frontières team, also known as MSF, steps in with medical and humanitarian assistance.
We have been practicing medical emergencies.
MSF project coordinator for the past 7 years and spokesperson, Renata Sinke, believes that European governments are obstructing life-saving sea operations and returning rescued people to unsafe Libya.
What we currently are seeing is definitely that European governments and all their politics are focused on a reduced search and rescue capacity on the central Mediterranean Sea, one of the most deadliest seas in this world at the moment, rather than really prioritizing sufficient capacity for rescues and safe routes for migrants, refugees and asylum seekers to go to Europe.
It appears that the European Union, with its security and containment strategy, has confronted itself with the moral question: should rescued people be handed over to authorities where torture and violation of human rights continue to be reported? There are also critics who say that MSF is disregarding Libya's contiguous zone and is providing a pull factor for economic migrants who want to reach the European Union. Renata Sinke says such views are misleading.
Doctors Without Borders has been already for quite a while, together with other NGOs, accused of being a pull factor. I think that's absolutely wrong, and we need to focus on the push factor. We see people here, we speak to people who are telling their stories, where they're coming from, their countries of origin, but also their situation in Libya, and it's the push factor, it's the lack of healthcare, the torture, the violence, and the poverty in the countries that they're fleeing from that are the reason that trigger for them to do this journey, and not so much the fact that NGO boats might be in the water.
Faculty 2, leader and first team member arrived. We start preparing the boat.
Yeah, roger that, thank you.
First crew, easy one.
Yeah, go ahead, easy one.
SOS Mediterranean Search and Rescue head coordinator is Nick Romaniuk. Originally from the UK, Nick's work over the past 18 years has taken him across the North Atlantic, Indian Ocean, and the West African coast. It's his third year in the SAR zone. Nick says SOS has considered other North African countries such as Tunisia and Egypt as disembarkation points for rescued people. On the other hand, there's also the question if such countries have a MRCC, that is a Maritime Rescue Coordination Centre.
We've definitely had a conversation regarding Tunisia. For the time being, there is no real reception for disembarkation of rescued people in Tunisia. They do not have an MRCC at the moment, and they don't have the capacity to welcome people as a port of safety. So it has been discussed, but we would not consider Tunisia for the time being to be a port of safety.
MSF Humanitarian Affairs Officer Catalina Arenas says in instances where families attempt to cross the central Mediterranean and become separated, little is done among North African authorities to reunite relatives.
We also receive testimonies about families that were splitted during their journeys. We had a testimony, it was the stepfather of two Cameroonian boys. One of them was evacuated with his mother to Tunisia. Until now, they are still separate.
SOS team, if all boats are ready...
Given that Libya is a country plunged in civil war, with two separate power-seeking governments and a kaleidoscope of militias, is there anything that would assure and convince Nick Romaniuk that the North African country is a safe place for rescued people to return?
I mean, for me, it's the question, the instability in Libya means that it's still very dangerous for people. Every single person that we've rescued initially might be fleeing from a different conflict or from poverty within their country of origin. As they transit through Libya, a lot of them are saying to us that they are now fleeing from Libya itself. So we could not take people back to Libya because they're demonstrating a fear of persecution, of detention, arbitrary detention, as soon as they go back.
With the Italian prosecutor's office sequestering the Spanish NGO ship Open Arms, MSF spokesperson Renata Cinque says there is a criminalization campaign against NGOs that carry out patrols in the central Mediterranean Sea, and this has resulted in reduced search and rescue activities.
Already for about a year, since Italian authorities came up with a very ill-conceived code of conduct. Since then, we've seen an increased trend of criminalizations against INGOs, NGOs operating on the central Mediterranean Sea. And at this given moment, today, the Aquarius is the only NGO vessel out there, which is definitely not enough for the possible needs and the high number of boats that will still depart the shores of Libya.
Testimonies given by rescued people on board the Aquarius follow a pattern. Migrants and refugees tell of stories where violence, abuse, and exploitation by human traffickers are rife in the North African state. According to NGO figures, between 750,000 and 900,000 immigrants, asylum seekers, and refugees remain trapped in Libya. Many see only one way out, that is to attempt to cross one of the world's current most deadliest seas in rubber dinghies that can only be considered as floating death traps. Philip Warwick, DW, on board the SOS MSF Aquarius.
Song is Moni by Kanda Bongoman. He's an African musical legend from the DR Congo. He started his career in the 70s and his dance style, Kwasa Kwasa, made him a darling of Soukous music fans across Africa and beyond. In this dance move, the hips move back and forth vigorously while the hands move to follow the hips. He migrated to the UK where he is still performing. If you're just joining us, this is Spotlight on Europe with me, Wanjiku Mwaura. Now, getting back to the topic of migration, if you're an African and have ever gone through a visa application process, then you will be aware that some countries require a long list of evidence that you will go back to your home country. But that doesn't apply to everyone. European Union passports are up for sale to rich outsiders who wouldn't be able to enter the EU any other way. From Brussels, Terry Schulz reports that those EU governments who sell the so-called golden visas are accused of ignoring applicants' backgrounds, and apparently Brussels is turning a blind eye too. Take a listen.
If government records are to be believed, scores of Russian millionaires are building new lives in the European Union as proud Maltese citizens. Some having recorded their latest abodes as abandoned gas stations or garages. Blogger Manuel Delia has tried to drop in on a few of his new compatriots at their official addresses, but they never seem to be home. Malta is among those EU governments which are flat out selling passports to anyone who can afford them. And in many cases, rather than hiding the practice, the governments actually market it with golden visa expos. Delia is outraged and thinks other people should be too.
It's an uncontrolled backdoor to Europe, and it's institutionalized fraud. In theory, there's supposed to be scrutiny. There's supposed to be due diligence. The law, however, is very clear. If a terrorist comes here, if a criminal comes here, the government has the right to give them a passport. There's no problem with that.
The European Commission, the EC, doesn't seem to see the matter as particularly worrying. Asked this month about the proliferation of the practice, EC spokesman Christian Wiegand simply reiterated the rules and said the Commission is watching.
Principles laid down in international law require the existence of a genuine link between the applicant and the country or its nationals. So, as national citizenship is the precondition for the EU citizenship and the entry of treaty rights, the Commission is closely monitoring the application of investor schemes, granting national citizenship in member states.
Wiegand says the Commission will publish a report on investor citizenship later this year, but he would not clarify whether that report will simply summarize how member states handle the golden visa issue or whether it will scrutinize procedures and the possibility for corruption. As for genuine ties to European countries, Delia explains what the process of becoming Maltese now looks like.
They just fly in the country, they drive to the passport office, sign a few papers, fly back out, and we never see them again.
With this popular new export, Malta has been able to go from national deficit to surplus in just a couple of years. But it's not the only one. Cyprus is another quick path to Europe for the well-heeled, and some of its new citizens are getting serious scrutiny from outside the country, if not inside. Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska became a Cypriot last year. His name has been linked most recently with the U.S. investigation into President Donald Trump's ties to Russia. A new journalistic investigation lays bare how widespread the programs are. Under the Global Anti-Corruption Consortium, which includes the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, the OCCRP, Transparency International, and Global Witness, 20 reporters spent half a year examining the situation in a dozen countries. OCCRP regional editor Jody McPhillips describes their investigation in Montenegro, NATO's newest member and an EU aspirant. McPhillips says the EU told Montenegro that if it wants to be part of the bloc, which would give its citizens access to the whole EU, it had to stop selling passports. McPhillips say the program was put on hold, but now is potentially being resurrected.
So this is an area to keep a close watch on. We found some pretty interesting characters who are new Montenegrins. It's pretty irresistible for a country, generally small, generally not terribly well governed, who has financial trouble. This is a game changer.
It's not always clear whose game is getting the change, however. Miklós Ligeti, head of legal affairs at Transparency International in Hungary, explains how this works in Budapest. The visas are sold through bond packages, he says, which raised almost $240 million over roughly 4 years before the program was suspended. However, Ligeti says, it's not the government itself selling the bonds, and it's completely unclear where all that money went.
These intermediary organizations generate the revenues at the expense of Hungarian taxpayers' money. But on top of that, this is an invitation to individuals whose assets are coming from unknown resources to launder their potentially ill-gotten money into Hungary's and potentially Europe's capital markets.
With all the concern about who's getting into the EU's Schengen system of visa-free travel via migration routes, Rachel Owens of the anti-corruption NGO Global Witness says she's appalled authorities seem to be unconcerned about what she calls a serious security risk.
The cousin of the Syrian dictator is able to get access to an EU passport despite being on the US sanctions list. The EU's core values of security, freedom of movement are at risk through these schemes.
Global Witness has presented a list of recommendations to the EC, demanding more checks on applicants and their money in this billion-dollar industry. But Malta's Delia says the security aspect, while critical, is not his biggest complaint. He's most disturbed by the fact that people who really need international protection are turned down by EU governments, while rich business people are welcomed in. And he believes that's all to the detriment of his country's own character. We have given our rights and our traditions and our history, Delia says, and put it on sale. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
And now we move on to Turkey, where being an Uber driver in Istanbul is becoming an increasingly risky affair. The Uber internet car service is proving extremely popular in the country's largest city, so much so that regular taxi drivers have started to attack the Uber drivers. Dorian Jones reports on the growing violence.
A late-night trip for these Uber passengers turned into a nightmare. A taxi driver cut off the car these women were traveling in and then proceeds to attack it with a club. The Uber driver eventually manages to escape the attacker as the terrified passengers scream. Such incidents are becoming increasingly common, and like this one, many are captured on smartphones and are circulating the internet. Uber drivers using minivans have become easy targets for enraged taxi drivers. For this Uber driver, who wanted to remain anonymous, he admits it's becoming an increasingly dangerous job.
Taksiciler kesti. Kapıyı açıp direkt içeriden çektiler beni.
We experience personal verbal attacks as well as increasing violence, like people kicking and attacking our cars or blocking our way. Yesterday, three taxis cut me off and didn't let me pass. Some other colleagues have experienced harsher attacks than mine, which are relatively small incidents. But there are cases of armed attacks with guns or clubs. Drivers I know have been beaten. It usually happens at night.
A popular tactic used by taxi drivers is to call out Uber drivers to a remote location and then beat up the driver. Several Uber drivers have been hospitalized. At a taxi rank in central Istanbul, there is little sympathy for the attacked Uber drivers. There is anger here. Most drivers rent the taxi for around 2,000 euros a month. To buy an Istanbul taxi plate costs several hundred thousand euros. With petrol in Turkey the second most expensive in Europe, life was already hard even before the emergence of Uber. Veteran taxi driver Mehmet Ataş says the violence against Uber drivers is understandable.
Even though we say we're against violence, they are provoking us to use force. We are working until 3 or 4 in the morning to make a little money. Why do I have to share the little that I make with an Uber driver? Our income has dropped 30 to 35% and our expenses have increased. The rent of the taxi used to be around 7,000 to 7,200 Turkish lira, but now it can be up to 7,800 or even 8,000. Our bread is now in the hands of Uber. This is the biggest problem. I've been doing this job for 25 years. I started driving a taxi when I was 17, without a driver's license. I still do this job with love, but every day is worse than the day before. Our country is in a dire economic situation, and our people should stand side by side with the taxi drivers rather than supporting a global economical force.
Uber's system of paying an agreed fee by credit card in advance is especially popular among Istanbul users. In fact, nearly everyone you meet has a story of being ripped off or tricked by taxis. The recent story of a poor Saudi tourist who wanted to go to the airport and was taken on a four-hour tour of the city, costing him several hundred dollars and a missed plane, made headline news and remains a talk of the city. Istanbul's taxis also have a reputation of being badly maintained and unroadworthy. In central Istanbul, public sentiments appear overwhelmingly behind Uber.
If it's a long journey, maybe if I go to airport or a longer journey, I take Uber. Because it is more spacey and it's more reliable, they are on time. And even sometimes more expensive, but I prefer Uber.
It's also safe because you are in a system and you call Uber from that system, you know, I mean, though it's safe.
But this man thinks the controversy is all getting out of hand.
The taxi and Ubers, the fight between them, I think. The only problem is the people's attitude against each other. There is no winners. It worries the traffic, it worries people's feelings, and there's no need. They can earn together. I don't see a problem between them.
Unbowed taxi drivers have gone to the courts seeking to ban Uber. Hundreds gathered outside Istanbul's main courthouse earlier this month, chanting, "Thieving Uber." Head of Istanbul's taxi association, Eyüp Aksu, sought to play down the threat of violence, but warns the driver's patience is running out.
Avrupa ülkelerinde taksicilerin eylem yapıp...
We don't want to stage a protest like the protest of the taxi drivers in Europe who burnt and destroyed areas. But if our parliament doesn't carry out the necessary regulation, and if the judiciary give a contrary decision to what we are demanding, then taxi drivers will run out of patience, and they'll do anything for their bread and for their work.
But taxi drivers do have a powerful patron, the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The drivers are traditionally among his most loyal supporters, and the president has always prided himself as being their advocate. Erdogan and his close associates are also rumored to be among the largest owners of taxi plates in Istanbul. With such powerful backers, it's leaving many taxi drivers confident of victory. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Spotlight on Europe. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We would love to connect with you on our Facebook page, DW Africa, or you can also write to us an email via feedback.africa@dw.com. Thanks to the rest of the team, Eliane Giaducci, Natalie Muller, Susan Holton, and our technician, Gerd Georgi, and thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week with another edition of Spotlight on Europe. I'm Wanjiko Mwaura, and from all of us here at DW, have a wonderful time. So I'ma hit a bang bang, oh yeah, bang bang. Open the door to your heart, oh bang bang. I'ma hit a bang bang to you, open what I know gonna be.